six representatives. We've got a quorum here. And we'll do SB 216 first. I don't know what the rest of the order is. Possibly Mark Hanley will be here shortly. Do we have a sponsor here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 216 is the governor's fee bill. It's had hearings in both the House and the Senate side now. It's does several things. That you should have a copy of a spreadsheet like this in your packet that goes through the sections. And that might be the easiest thing to do. We have representatives from the agencies here that to respond to questions on this particular bill. For the record, I'm Nancy Slagle, Division of Budget Review.
Okay, maybe what we'll do, we'll take all the testimony first, and then we'll see what kind of amendments we've got. Looks like we've got two people here. Two people, three people, four people. Okay, we'll do the first one. Janet Oakes with Providence.
Do you want me to just walk through this bill real quickly just to see what's in there?
Hold it.
And then where questions are, come up, we can answer those. Section 1 is with the Department of Commerce and Economic Development dealing with Real Estate Surety Fund. Basically, this allows the department to charge for hearing costs directly against the Real Estate Surety Fund. In the past, it has been against the general fund. And then if the other side, when the decision comes down, it is determined whether this can be drawn down from the Real Estate Surety Fund or not. This basically lets the costs come out of that fund up front. So this results in a fund source switch of a small amount of money, but it does help with the shrinking amount of general fund dollars, and also with the Real Estate Surety Fund, there's a cap on how much can be held in that fund, and this allows us to utilize that as we're approaching that cap. Section 2 is Post-Secondary Education Commission. It allows the department to charge post-secondary institutions for the application process, the application fees, and this is to cover the costs of processing those fees. It's anticipated this would be based on a sliding scale dependent upon tuition fees, revenues that the private or the institution anticipates. Section 3 is the Human Rights Commission. This allows the Human Rights Commission to charge fees. They do not have that ability now. This would allow them to charge for training that's provided, services, materials that, and again, in the time of shrinking budgets, this allows them to do a little bit more. Section 4 is with Department of Labor, the workers' comp section. This basically allows us to charge a 4% user fee on all to those in those entities that are self-insured. This exempts municipalities, local governments from this coverage, but it the intent here is to cover the costs that the state incurs from processing and hearings on disputed claims that we provide to those self-insureds. Somewhat in the same respect that is being charged to those that are under the workers' comp program, the state's program. Section 5 allows the Department of Natural Resources to charge a fee specifically related to the exploration credit incentive program for mine development. And this goes hand in hand with the section that's in Senate Bill 215 that has to do with streamlining the process of when those credits or those applications for credits are processed. Section 6 was added on the Senate side. This allows the allows municipalities to charge for prisoners that they are have in their facilities. It would basically cover, they could charge for room, board, personal expenses up to $70 a day. It's very similar in respect, I guess, to what the state does with the DWI type of.
Mulder?
Nancy, will this allow the state, I mean, there are contracts right now with those cities, I assume. These are the so-called contract jails?
It allows municipalities charge for those that are in municipal facilities, and so if it's contract jails, I'm not sure because we're paying for it. Hold on. Do we have somebody? Jerry? Can you take this? I don't want to say anything that's not correct.
Record, my name is Jerry Schreiner, Department of Corrections. It's my understanding that the fees would only apply to prisoners held as municipal prisoners. It would not apply to prisoners held as state offenders. In other words, the city of Juneau, for example, who holds some of their prisoners out at Gastineau Human Services, under city ordinances could charge $70 a day. If that same police officer arrested someone on a state charge and they were held in Lemon Creek, for example, even though they were arrested by a city officer, if they were held on a state charge, I don't believe this would allow us to charge them that fee.
Okay. That was the real question. I mean, there are some folks like Juneau who are prosecuting under municipal ordinance, but they do house them over Lemon Creek, correct?
They house the vast majority of their offenders at Gastineau Human Services. Some are held at Lemon Creek. Generally, it's if the individual is too risky.
Okay, so the net impact on the general fund is nothing. It just allows them some ability. And in some ways, I think this is a good idea because if we're going to try and encourage local governments to become more responsible for their own law and order and incarceration, this gives them an additional tool to do that.
Parnell?
A little different side. Neck, does Neck still have a contract jail or King Salmon? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
Well, let's just, for instance, say Neck still has the contract jail and state pays for space to be available under the contract. My question would be, are they then able to charge the prisoner that they're going to put in that jail $70 a day, and they're collecting money from the state for that bed, and they're collecting money from the prisoner for that bed as well. So are the municipalities going to be getting twice, the fee twice?
I don't think they get it twice. If they have municipal ordinances and the person is held for a charge that's a municipal ordinance, presumably that municipality could charge them $70. If they charge under state statutes, then they would not be able to charge the $70.
Well, it depends on how we're paying our contracts. So if we're paying it by the person as they come in on a state charge, or if we're paying for two beds to be available for 4 weeks a month,
The contracts are paid. They're a lump sum contract.
Right.
They don't relate to how many people are there. So yes, theoretically, we could pay for X number of beds. We do pay for the beds, whether they're full or not. So that's right.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, that's exactly the question I was going at. And I'm glad you restated it, because the way I understand it, it wasn't going to be. It was only going to affect those who prosecute our municipal law. Now, NACNEC, I don't believe, has municipal ordinance. They prosecute everybody under state law.
Dillingham?
I think the only two entities that are prosecuting under municipal ordinance right now are Juneau and Anchorage. Everybody else is prosecuting under state in terms of anything for any time period. So, but I think it's a good question that I would like to have answered to make certain that they're not, in essence, double-dipping, getting a contract from the state and being able to touch the prisoner.
Unless it offsets the cost of the state.
Yeah, exactly. That was the point of, or focus of my point, was that if it were, then we should be able to offset some cost to the state.
It was my understanding that this was pretty limited in who would be affected by this.
Okay.
Abraham.
What if we said may charge for these expenses of a prisoner prosecuted under municipal ordinance? On line 21, page 3. And just link it to prosecution under the municipal ordinance as a incentive for municipalities. Because this would then provide them some amount of offset for the revenue and encourage them to take that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And to state that again?
On line 21, instead of personal expenses of the prisoner, say personal expenses of a prisoner prosecuted under municipal ordinance.
Mr. Chairman?
Cornell?
Could you say prosecuted or held?
Prosecuted or held.
Charging decisions are made later.
So. Okay. I'll take that as an amendment. Any objection? Okay. It's passed. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 7 is allowing municipalities to charge for, or requiring municipalities to charge for marine and harbor facilities that would basically allow them to charge enough to cover the cost of repair and maintenance and upkeep of those marine and harbor facilities. Section 8 and Section 12 both deal with the removal of the exemption on gasohol from the definition of motor fuel. This, with the removal of this, it basically would generate substantial amount of money for the state. That we've lost about $6 million this year because this has not been...
Ariel?
That's because the EPA requirements, the clean air requirements, cause us to use gasohol, but gasohol is tax-free.
The statutes specifically identify gasohol as an exemption from the motor fuel, the definition of motor fuel for tax purposes, and this removes it. Basically, we're finding an increased amount of sales of gasohol, in, it's my understanding, is was fairly limited before, during the specific time of the year, and now that we're seeing that gasohol is being provided or being sold more throughout the year than what was originally identified. We do have a representative from the Department of Revenue here who can speak more on it.
So, Bob, we lost revenue when we went into seasonal usage, but now the refiners are producing and selling larger quantities year-round?
Correct. To the chair of Ontario, we've got a kind of a graph available that just shows basically that the use, currently it's the use of gasohol is required for 4 months in the winter, and we're just seeing that it's now becoming something that's going to be sold year-round. And the original intention of the exemption was back in the 70s if they were going to use Delta barley to produce gas. And now that's not kind of the situation. It is a requirement to use the gasohol. But I don't think there was an intention to exempt that from taxation. And this would remove it so that all fuel sold would be subject to the state's motor fuel tax. And in FY96, we estimate we're going to lose over $6 million each year. and that could grow. It's looking like it's going to grow.
You know, the price, is there a price increase at the pump for gasohol, and the tax was basically to offset that, or is now the price for gasohol and unleaded relatively the same?
Well, the Department of Environmental Conservation did look into that and worked a little bit with industry, and there's a cost to use gasohol, and when that went into place, they didn't see a change in price up or down. When the tax is added on, I think the question is going to become whether they'll continue to sell the gasohol year-round or go back to just seasonal, and I don't know how that will affect their pricing.
Finally, is this just a tax break, or there's no motor fuel tax?
There's no motor fuel tax charge. It's completely exempt from the eight. It's currently 8 cents a gallon, and they would pay. They have been paying zero.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Martin,
I'd like 92% of this bill, and I thank Nancy for the breakdown. It's a very neat way to understand what's at stake. Oh, I thought you was.
No, there's a couple. There's about three more sections.
I'm in Russia. It's just been a long time. I'm sorry, in a minute.
I'm precious.
Yes. Section 9 is dealing with the occupational licensing, and basically what we do now is we charge $50 every 2 years for a business license. This has not changed since statehood. What we're doing here is increasing it to $75 every 2 years. So it's an increase of $12.50 a year for a business license. Section 10 is gives the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs the ability to charge fees for providing emergency management response training. Right now, they have the ability to charge fees for response training dealing specifically with oil and hazardous substance spills, that type of thing. But there's nothing to allow them to charge fees for more comprehensive emergency response management. And the fees here would basically cover the cost of travel and facility rentals and those types of things specific to that that training that's being provided. Section 11 is Department of Environmental Conservation. There are two things that are added here. One of them is charging chemical firms for pesticide and broadcast chemical use. This would be amounts that would be charged to chemical manufacturing firms such as Dow, those types. And the other portion of it is dealing with allowing the department to charge for subdivision plan reviews of sewage, waste disposal, and treatment facilities. And that's basically the bill in a nutshell.
There you go. And then Mark.
The fees on lines 11 through 16 there on page 5, what are those estimated to be?
The pesticide and broadcast chemicals, that's expected to be $100,000, and the subdivision plan review fees is, I believe, $220,000. Oh, 22,000. Oh, because they changed it on the Senate side, so it restricted who we could charge plan review fees for. So that amount has actually dropped to 22,000.
So that's the estimated yearly income is what you're just quoting.
Right. Yes.
So what's that going to be for a subdivision plan? For a subdivision plan review.
Mr. Chairman, Janice Adair with DEC. This would allow us to charge a fee only in areas outside of an organized borough or a municipality. Only about 10% of our plans, subdivision plans, come from that part of the state. So using $300 as the estimated fee per subdivision plan. We came up with $22,000 as the estimated revenue.
Mulder?
That says $300?
$300
per?
Correct.
Isn't it conceivably, Janice, isn't it possible to either adopt regulations which would allow that a civil engineer could adopt or draw up these same plans? I mean, you see what I'm saying? That isn't it, they're going to be the ones who put the ultimate stamp on it anyway, and they're ultimately liable for approval of sewage plans. I mean, I know, just having gone through this myself, wouldn't that be an acceptable route as well, just to say, well, you've got a licensed civil engineer who's drawn up this plan, who's bought off on it. Wouldn't that be acceptable to you? Shouldn't that be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, that is in fact what happens now. A registered engineer typically does do a subdivision plan review, or a subdivision plan, sets out the plat, sizes the lots, and the subdivision plans are then run through the municipality, and in Anchorage, the municipality also does the review for water and wastewater. In all other areas of the state except Valdez, DEC does the compliance review for water and wastewater. What we're primarily looking at is wastewater, sewage disposal, to ensure that the lot is sized enough, depending on the type of sewage system. If it's an on-lot system, if it's hooking up to a community system, it's something different. But if this is going to be an on-lot sewage system, we look to ensure that the lot is sized and sufficient to accommodate whatever the sewage disposal system is, that it's far enough away from an on-lot water system, and it is a compliance check with the requirements of Title 46.
Isn't that, Mr. Chairman, isn't that what a civil engineer does as well? I mean, when they put their stamp of approval on it, it has to meet certain flow restrictions, size restrictions, et cetera.
Through the chair, Representative Mulder, I understand that most engineers are the review, the what their stamp ensures is that it complies with the ordinances or Title 29 requirements. And it this is different in Anchorage because Anchorage has adopted ordinances on this topic. Other areas of the state have not.
I guess I'm speaking in relation to experience in La Quina. There, it's my experience there. The engineer was fully aware of what the regulations, state regulations, were, and that's what he took his stamp to make certain that I was complying with state regulations. The only thing that I was making certain is that we were paying $300 for a paper shuffle.
Through the chair, Representative Mulder, we do review the work that they do, and there are instances where no other changes are necessary, but there are times when changes are in fact required to comply, and we will make those recommendations and make those changes. We have our own registered engineers do the reviews when they come into DEC, and they also stamp them with their seal before they are, usually this is a requirement, before they're accepted by municipal government.
Still not sold, Mr. Chairman, that a civil engineer could not do the same work and produce the same requirements as they are financially liable for making those kind of determinations. And they're going to be extremely cautious about making those kind of determinations and putting their name on any kind of document.
Agreed. By implication, when you say outside the organized borough, the implication is all organized boroughs would do their own?
Through the chair, Representative Terrio, that would be the implication. There was a letter of intent that was adopted by the Senate that made that clear.
So, but this is real contentious around the state. What negotiations has the administration had with the organized boroughs saying this is something that should be a local responsibility? You need to take this over, because they're none too happy about, sort of through the back door, you're making them take on something new.
Through the chair, Representative Terrio, that amendment was not ours and was not supported by the department. It happened just kind of lost track of the days, but it was just a couple days ago. And so we haven't had any conversations with any of the organized boroughs, except when they've called saying, what does this mean? It is a concern, because this will happen effective July 1, right in the middle of the construction season. I think with more time, some organized municipalities probably could do this. I think that there's a lot of second-class cities that simply do not have the wherewithal to ever do this. And that's the basis of our concerns, both the timing and not all local governments are equal.
Hey, Brown. You done, Jean?
Well, I guess, you know, if we take this language out, then we're imposing this new fee on all areas except for, would it be in Anchorage and Valdez, or do they have their own system so you wouldn't charge the fee there?
Through the chair, Representative Terrio, the fee would be paid by the developer, and no, where we don't do the plan reviews, we don't get involved with it, we don't charge the fee. So
okay.
Developers in Anchorage and Valdez would continue to work directly with the municipalities and pay the fees that those municipalities charge.
Right. So if we take this language out, then we're going to impose this new fee on the entire state except for Anchorage and Valdez. I really think the local communities should be doing this function, but I think there should be some negotiation between the administration and those governments. So I kind of think I feel like we're jumping the gun here with this entire section.
Mr. Chairman, we actually do support the restriction on the four lots where each lot is at least 1 acre in size. We think that's a good common. We typically don't look at those subdivisions anyway because they are big enough, and that also helps remind the department of where the priorities ought to be. So we have no problems with the second part of that. That amendment was also made in Senate Finance, and we don't have a problem with that one.
But the entire section is hinged around the fee. I mean, we wouldn't do away with the fee and have the have that language.
A.K. Brown and then Terry Martin.
What is the I don't have the prior version of the bill in front of me, and I'm not sure what language, Representative Terrio, when you say take it out, you mean just take out the whole thing or take out which part?
Outside of organized borough. Or municipality.
Let me ask it this way. What's the department's preferred approach right now at this point, given all the considerations?
Through the chair, Representative Brown, we would prefer to have outside of an organized borough or municipality deleted from the bill. And then that would allow us to continue to work with the municipal governments. I have had conversations with the director of AML, and I think that, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think we all recognize that there are some things that some local governments probably can do, but it does need to be part of a larger conversation.
Is it clear that municipalities have the authority to charge their own fees should they assume the function?
Through the chair, I actually tried to find that in statute, but I believe it's there. I just haven't been able to put my hands on it again the last couple of days, but I know I've seen something about that in the statute. And certainly Anchorage does charge a fee. Valdez charges a fee. So I'd presume that with the ordinance that they would adopt to take this function on, that ordinance would include a fee. I didn't find anything to preclude them in Title 29 from doing that. And there is specific language in DEC statute that says to the extent a program is done by municipal government, DEC may not charge a fee for that service. So that's very clear. If they're doing it, we don't charge the fee, and that would make sense because we're not doing the service.
Terry Martin and then Jean Terrio.
Thank you. My concern is directly with OMB, Nancy, if we can. I believe in closing the gap, and I'm very much pro fees. I have no problem with that, people paying for services. From a fiscal point of view, I know that some of these will be isolated, dedicated to those particular projects. How's that going to fit into our fiscal gap? I believe in bringing the front part of the book with the back part, so we know the total cost of state operation is 3.8. Billion, and I was wondering how would this play? What part goes into the front section, which ones would be dedicated and which one for general fund, like I'm assuming Section 12 revenues on the Gaster Hall will be just general funds. Which other ones, as you go down here quickly, Nancy, would be in the front category of dedicated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, there are only two sections that have, three that have any effect on expenditures. Some of these are fund source changes from pure general fund to program receipts, so that we're freeing up more of our unrestricted general fund. The occupational licensing, the business increase in the business license, that is a pure unrestricted general fund increase. That means more money coming, more revenues coming into the state, as with the Gaster Hall. So there's a very small amount that you're going to see in any expenditure increases. Mostly it's shifting away from the unrestricted general fund or adding more monies that the state is receiving.
And I don't mind that showing program receipts for a specific purpose, but I think it's part of the budget we need to keep on saying, because we have the front section and back section, it's all cost of government.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying. The only other thing I had has another thing to do on Section 4. Later on, I think that's the major problem with this bill. I'd like to push the bill through if we can solve that problem.
We have a representative from the Department of Labor here that can answer any questions on the workers' comp section.
But for the revenue closing, basically it looks like the $7.6 million, at least almost $7.2 is going to be actual general funds. Small, but a step forward.
Yes, even more than that. It's either, like I said, either shifting to a specific fund source so that we've got program receipts coming in and not drawing down from our unrestricted general fund or adding to the unrestricted.
Right, good. Thank you.
Ariel? I forgot what my question was.
I think we're still on that section earlier on outside of an organized borough. When you raise your hand.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move on page 5, line 13 and 14 that we delete outside of an organized borough-owned municipality.
Any objection? No objection. That's stricken. Anything else we can ask the administration here on this bill? Otherwise, I'm going to go into, and thank you very much. I'm going to go into some testimony. Ben.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the cost of prisoners here. I know there are some suggestions of a conceptual amendment. When we're dealing with, and this is on page 3, line 20, my concern, which I expressed to the mover of the amendment that was adopted, that we could set up a situation, if we have it prosecuted or held, we'd have basically a hotel that could be beneficial to both parties involved, where you could detain a person for 24 hours and then release them, and that would count as the $70. If we reversed it and said held and prosecuted, that would perhaps clarify it a little bit more clear to the people that were doing it. But we have now prosecuted or held. Well, you know, if you have a municipal jail and you have a few empty beds, it's pretty easy to find a reason to detain somebody for 24 hours, of which that person may even be agreeable to. And I don't think we want to put ourselves in that position. So I'd recommend that we at least start and then check with legal with held and prosecuted.
Objection.
So in essence, I guess it would be a rescission, a reversal of an amendment that we had adopted to at least put it where we think it's more proper to protect our financial interests
So you want to...
You mean return it back to the original language?
No, it would be, we had added, and it came to my attention after the Representative Parnell made it, I called him over here, and I was trying to, you know, say, well, I kind of questioned the use of the word, you know, prosecute or held, and now thinking about it, reverse it, held and prosecuted.
Then you want to rescind our action?
And I guess the motion probably would be to rescind our action in adopting prosecuted or held. Maybe, Mr. Chairman, you could ask if there are any objections to rescinding our action.
No objection? Okay, do you have it right then, Lynn?
Well, I'm confused. Do you want it to be held or prosecuted before you had prosecuted or held? Or do you want it to be held and prosecuted?
Held.
That's it.
A second.
Held and prosecuted.
That's
okay, no objection. That's passed.
Well, I guess if it's understood what we have done here.
We rescinded our action. The motion's back before us. It appears
any objection to the...
And now I'm going to...
Motion.
Go ahead.
I'm going to amend the amendment.
There's no
B.
Amendment. Okay.
Well, the amendment is still alive before us,
right,
which we adopted.
Right.
So I'm going to amend the amendment to say held and prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. Any objection? No objection? Then that change is made. Okay.
Good thinking, Ben.
I'm trying to go into public testimony right now.
I don't sleep too much.
Jerry Martin?
We at the Department of Labor, and I guess there's a number of other people that want to discuss Section 4. From my review of this, it looks like this is the only controversial thing right now. And the bill, I like 92%, and I don't want the thing to be hung up because of one section. So if someone from the Department of Labor could explain the reason for this increase, and then we'll have others to express their concerns about it.
That's fine. Dwight?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dwight Perkins, Special Assistant to Commissioner Cashin at the Department of Labor. I have with me today the Director of Workers' Comp, Mr. Paul Grossi, with me. Mr. Grossi can answer any of the technical questions that may be needed to answer. I believe I'll let him start off by saying why we came to this. Your question, Representative Martin, I believe, is what is the reason for this at this time? So I guess Mr. Grossi would be the best one to speak on that, sir.
The basic reason we proposed this change was to, for the record, I'm Paul Grossi, I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation, was to roughly approximate the fee that employers pay when they buy a workers' compensation insurance policy. Right now, the self-insurers don't pay a fee. They may have purchased an excess policy, a catastrophic policy, which would generate some premium tax, but that's a relatively small amount compared to the employers who purchase workers' compensation insurance policy. So basically what it's for, it's a fairness issue. We're trying to propose a legislation that would help self-insurers pay their fair share. And it's rough. I'd be kidding you if I said this was an exact number. It's a rough approximation, but we believe it's actually slightly less than what they would have paid if they had purchased a workers' compensation insurance policy.
Are state and municipal governments exempt from this?
They are.
When we talk about the fairness issue, why people...
Well, in the original bill that the administration put in, we did include the municipalities and everybody but the state, and the reason we excluded the state was because we felt that the state was paying everything already. And so it would be just moving money from one pocket into the next. I believe it was Senate Finance amended the bill to exclude the municipalities and the other public entities, Senate Labor and Commerce. And they did that. I don't want to speak for them, but I believe what they did it for was because they saw it as a pass-through. And so they chose to exclude those entities.
The university and school systems?
As well.
Is that done, sir?
They are exempt as well now.
Well, I'd hate to have the whole bill hung up for just one section, to be honest with you. And you knew what the amendment was offered by those who are concerned that this is going to be exorbitant costs. We haven't heard from them yet. But if this amendment were offered, what problems would you have with it?
I'm not sure exactly what amendment you're talking about, but...
Under Donald C. Mr. Chairman, could I have this...
Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, while that's happening, may I go to a more basic question, I think?
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. We're talking about the self-insurer. Mm-hmm. And there was some discussion in regards to fairness. And I'm wondering that fairness, you know, they pay their fair share. I guess the fairness could go two ways. And I don't know that much about this subject, and I'll be first to admit it. But is there any way through regulations and things that you could adjust this to the self-insurers program or that they have out by maybe saying a fee of up to 4%, and then by regulations being able to tailor that to the program that the self-insurer has? I don't know, but it's just something that just crossed my mind as I looked at this. Is that possible, or is there legal restrictions or litigation?
Through the chair, Representative Grusendorf, I believe it would be possible, but I'm not really clear as to exactly how that, you know, what the mechanism would be.
What I was saying is up to 4% and then work it out there. But it said, you said it could be possible as an option. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Chairman.
If you can get my mind back on history, it seemed to me years ago we were trying to encourage private enterprise and the state and the university and the local government to become self-insured to help decrease the cost of general insurance plans. And it seemed to have worked very well, but what has happened now that we feel we need to charge them more, when the whole idea is that if you can get the whole cost of insurance down, health, and, you know, I'd rather exempt the hospital than I would municipal government in self-insurance programs from increases, because the patient's going to pay that one, and the whole thing, you know, just rackets up.
Representative Martin, through the chair, the only thing that's happened, of course, is we're now in a budget crunch. Before when we had lots of money, it was, I don't think anybody really thought about it. It was a problem, I guess, from the inception of the self-insurance program that they overlooked that aspect of it. And but as far as trying to fix anything, well, you're right. They self-insurers they do save a lot of money by having this program. They obviously don't have to pay the profits to the insurance company, and they save it there. And they also have and they do a very good job. And, to their credit, I would commend them on this. They focus on their claims a little better, and they focus on safety a little better, so that they have a better record overall. They're approximately 18% of our workload, but they constitute 23% of the workforce. So they are doing, you know, a good job. I would agree with you there, but still they do encompass some of our workload.
Is there a direct link then? I'm worried about one of the people that sent some facts down here. Cars, and they're a big employer of low and medium range scale of people. And if it's going to impact the number of first line entry jobs for young people, and they said this is, you know, somewhat similar to a mandatory pay, lower wage benefit, and therefore it may cut or increase the cost of employment of people. And so I may have a better insurance program, I won't have any insurance program, or I may not be employed. It's all these cost factors that need to be, I guess, as many thousands as he hires, it makes a major difference in 4% increase.
Well, I'm not, Representative Martin, through the chair, I'm not really certain exactly what the impact to this business would be, but it'd be approximately $55,000, the charge to cars. I don't know what their total sales is, but it's a, you know, and I don't know exactly what their profit margin is, but that, you know, it would, I don't know if it would have a fiscal impact on them. Yeah. I just don't know what the impact is.
Well, understanding that business with Freddie Myers and all, they're talking fractions of a penny for a pound of potatoes, you know, to make a profit.
Mm-hmm. Terrio and then Mulder.
So the 4% that you're charging is on the amount paid out on a yearly basis?
Exactly. It's on the previous year's claims experience on the individual company. You know, it's a different formula than, say, the premium. Premium tax is based on the total premium. It's a larger sum of money. The fees would be structured on the amount of claims. So it would have some sort of relationship to the amount of service that was rendered. It's and so it's a, but it's also a smaller amount of money total.
Mr. Mulder.
Mulder, I did get a copy of this amendment, and I don't know if you want me to specifically address this as we're speaking, or do you want to wait to as a follow-up to what Representative Terrio was talking about and get this other, maybe the questions on the 4% first?
Before you move to Representative Martin, I've been sitting here jotting down some language. Your intention is to try and cover your direct cost. Is that correct? Does 4% exceed your cost?
Well, it's, well, if you, our total cost for just our division is $2.6 million, so it wouldn't come close to covering our direct cost.
Well, I understand,
cost.
But they don't derive all of your administrative work either.
That's exactly, that's correct. It's an approximation. You know, it's not exact. I can't say that it's exact, but it's, you know, it's a fair approximation.
Maybe the
fair in your opinion.
Well, of course.
Mr. Chairman,
Coring?
I'd be happy to yield to you, Dwight. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, I guess what it comes down to, not that it comes down to, but part of the concern here, I believe, first of all, referring to this amendment of $100 fee that has been offered, I believe it's, you know,
if I may, for purpose of discussion, may I move the amendment?
No objection.
I'll object.
Okay, for discussion purposes of this $100 fee, quite frankly, sir, I think, you know, it's a little offensive to the department. On May the 3rd, we started responding from letters from industry, if you will, about this fees bill. And we, I believe in your packet also, you have a memo from Mr. Grossi to Mr. Purcell and a copy of the WCCA sounder. Although, you know, our intentions from Mr. Grossi and the Department of Labor that went up and met with the WCCA, that we did talk to the industry with this, I guess the concern we have is, on May 3rd, when we start getting problems or concerns regarding this legislation, our full intentions were to make this part of the fees bill from the time we were asked about it and through the administration. And so it would be as offensive, maybe, and I don't mean that, you know, as a mean thing, but it's a little disturbing that I think it would be just as disturbing for the industry if we were to come in and do away with do away with things as it is with the self-insurers and go everybody just pay 2.7%. But it's a little bit harsh right now to try at this late of the game to try to go back and work something out. We feel we have in our best interest, and I believe industry will say the same thing. You know, Mr. Grossi has been always open and fair with the WCCA and other groups regarding this particular topic. And so currently the self-insureds are receiving they're receiving work from the department, and the same type of work from the department as the ones that are not self-insured, and they're receiving a benefit, if you will, from the department, and not paying for it. So I think it was talked about earlier, maybe a little more equity here, and quite frankly, you know, the cost of doing business, and Mr. Grossi's division has dropped substantially over the years, and I don't mean to be argumentative on this at all. Please don't misunderstand me on it, but I'm just trying to state the facts here, and we have and we've had to react to concerns that came from some folks, and we feel we have made a good faith effort to date on this. Thank you.
Well, past, but one question just came to mind. You mentioned the benefit. Can you elaborate on precisely what these folks are receiving in terms of the benefit that aren't paying?
Well, it'd be programmatic, and I think Mr. Grossi would be able to discuss to talk on that better than I, sir.
Representative Corning, through the chair. Well, there's a number of things. We, of course, we do run the self-insured. In other words, that's through it's regulated through our division. And so that's something that we do there. Plus, we conduct hearings to resolve disputes. We keep a case log of injuries, and we database, and we provide information service for both the employees and employers. We have a self-insurance. No, I'm sorry, a second injury fund. And a number of just basic, you know, services that deal with workers' compensation.
I'm just, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue a little bit here. Just a little bit concerned about the self-insurers out there. I've been hearing from different entities, from some home builders folks in my area, and others, as reflected in the files here from letters that we've been received, that it might not be a real equitable situation, and that these self-insurers are having to pay for something that they feel they're not deriving a benefit from, and also the issue of the state and local governments being exempted from this. They also see that as an unfair matter as well, in terms of them not contributing to the costs associated with administering the program here. So I have a fairly high comfort. I don't have a very high comfort level at this point, just in light of that. Perhaps you can discuss that a little bit more for me.
I'm sorry. You don't have a comfort level as with this amendment? Is that what you're saying? Or?
I don't have a very high comfort level with the fact that you guys would like to see this 4% be assessed to the self-insurers here. So perhaps you can...
Well, I mean, I guess is the way we're looking at it is that the employers who go out and purchase a workers' compensation insurance policy... as all policies, they pay a 2.7% annual premium tax. Whereas, because self-insureds don't have to pay that or don't have to purchase a full workers' compensation policy, they don't pay that. So we're looking at it as this, you know, while the fees generated on the premium tax just go into general fund, it still is, you know, it is a cost that the employers pay. The self-insurers do pay some premium tax, but it's not, you know, it's on their catastrophic or excess insurance, and that's a relatively small number compared to what they would be charged if they had purchased a workers' compensation, full coverage workers' compensation insurance policy. So I guess that's kind of the way we're looking at it. Fairness. I don't know if that explains it. And, you know, it's not exact. I'll always repeat that it isn't exact.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, committee members, in your packet on the memorandum letter, Mr. Grossi in the number one on the last paragraph gives a little example of how this worked. A seafood company recently became self-insured. Their last workers' compensation policy premium was $1.4 million. I'm just rounding off. This would generate a premium tax of over $37,000. Last year, if the company were charged a 4% fee on all compensation paid, that is, the paid out on the workers got hurt, they would have paid under $15,000 to the state. It's only on those claims that are filed that the 4% kicks in. Mm-hmm. And so you know, there is a significant savings here.
I would add one more thing to that. And even if you add in their excess premium tax, they'd still only be paying $20,000, approximately.
The real question in my mind is, what is it costing the state to process the claims? Is there a way of calculating? I mean, because the whole concept here is that the user is going to offset the costs of administering the program. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of deriving?
It's a very difficult way of doing it, because,
well, I mean, if we're going to exempt out municipality, if we're going to exempt out municipalities, we're going to exempt out the states, there should be a pro rata share applied to which their work is deriving, or their claims are deriving your work schedule. Mm-hmm. So that, in other words, the self-insureds aren't going to be paying for the fact that the state isn't. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, I could support the concept of the people who are driving a service paying for the fraction or the portion of cost of the service they're receiving. Is that an acceptable concept?
It is an acceptable concept, you know, but it's, at this point, it's impossible to give you those figures. I mean, and also you have to look into it. You have to remember, too, that it's not just the Division of Workers' Compensation, but you have to think in terms of occupational safety and health, which fit, which fits in there, too. And you have to look at the Division of Insurance, and plus all the various ancillary costs, such as the administration, Department of Law, and, you know, even the various commissioners' offices, and probably the governor's office would have some, you know, portion of that calculation. I mean, that's why it's a very difficult number to come up with.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I mean, I don't think it's so difficult in the sense that you could, working with the affected industries, come up with an equation or a group of the acceptable assessments that go into it, because you're doing it retrospectively, in the sense that you take how much the claims were last year, also the amount of administrative overhead, mm-hmm. and you divide it into that assessment, and it's pretty easy to come up with a fee, it yeah. seemed to me.
But that's not, I mean, I you could do that, but that would that actually accurately reflect the state's cost and the total program? And I guess that's the question.
Well, certainly it's not going to totally cover the cost of the program, because we've exempted our municipalities in the state.
No, if you just take the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's not just the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Right? Well, I agree, and I acknowledge that. But I'm saying, when you're doing the analysis in terms of the cost, you not only include workers' comp, but you include in the other factors, you know, working with the industry, come up with the regulatory process, the parts that should be included in the overall assessment. That's why I was sitting here thinking in my mind, perhaps some language going to the degree shall pay a fee through regulation to cover the direct cost of administrative overhead by the department, not to exceed 4% of the total amount reported by the report, or whatever. Something along those lines.
I'm sorry.
Department.
Otherwise, Mr. Grassi, I
see your point.
Otherwise, I'm fairly confident we're going to be here revisiting this issue again next year.
Well, there's that's a possibility, I'm sure. But I suppose it could be done. I'm not exactly sure, you know, how to I can't give you an answer today, exactly how that could be done.
Mr. Chairman, can we have Mr. Tolson respond to the points made?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder. I'm here representing Cargassian Foods Company, and we have a big interest in this primarily because of the four largest self-insurers. We're number four. We're the first one that would pay anything. The first would be the state of Alaska, then the municipality of Anchorage, then the school district, who would all be exempt. Our costs over the last 4 years would have averaged about $57,000. We see this as a tax that we would pay for something that that we didn't purchase. That's the way that that we see it. We're self-insured because we wanted to save money. Does self-insurance always mean you save money? No. There's insurers in the state who used to write workers' compensation insurance who are no longer here because they couldn't make money doing it. I think we have a very good program. I think we have a model program. We're self-insured and we self-adjust our claims. We get, and I think Mr. Grossi would agree, we get people back to work fast. We want the system to work, and the system does work very well, and we use the system. We also pay part for using the system. Our fees on taxes for insurance last year were about $19,000. My understanding is that the fees generated on insurance premiums are more than is needed to directly fund the Division of Workers' Comp and the Division of Insurance. Now, you can throw general government into there and say Division of Workers' Comp gets some services from general government, which I'm sure they do. But on the other hand, I'm also sure that Cargassian pays more taxes than just on the insurance. So our position is that this really is a tax, that it's unfair, that people are exempted from it, that that shouldn't be exempted. One other thing I'd like to point out, too, and that was in Mr. Grossi's example of the seafood company. Having been a company that became self-insured at one point in time, the first year you're self-insured, your claims always look great because you're only dealing with claims for that year. We've got workers' compensation claims that we paid on for 95 that go back 6-7 years. So you've got that tail that catches up with you all the time. So I think, I don't know the specifics on this, but if this was the first year or second year they were in a program, their costs are going to reflect lower than they're going to be 3-4 years out in the program.
Mulder? Just a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. Eric, would you folks, do you think the people within the industry are willing to cover the cost of what they're costing the system?
I think we're certainly willing to take a look if we can find some way, and I think, you know, we've worked well with Mr. Grossi before. I think we're willing to take a look, and I'm speaking now both from CAR's perspective, and I'm also a member of WCCA, of if we can come up with something that makes sense. But, you know, we're not looking at a 4% fee, and I don't think there's time now to do anything other than that this year.
Well, I'm just out of curiosity, why didn't WCCA come out in opposition to this proposal when it was over on in the Senate side?
Well, I think we were a little behind the eight ball, actually, is what happened. We did meet with Mr. Grossi before. Mr. Grossi was very upfront with us. We told him that we were willing to work with him. And as of a couple of weeks ago, quite frankly, we didn't think the bill was going anywhere. And that's, and, you know, I guess we're too involved in our business trying to keep groceries on the shelves and things going to pay as much attention as we should have been.
I still have Grusendorf down. Did you have something?
And then Terrio and then Brown. Chairman, if I did, I passed. I may be just jerking like
okay,
this.
Okay. Terrio and then Brown.
You moved the amendment, or did you say?
Well, that? I have a couple questions for Mr. Grossi.
I did deal with it.
Grossi.
Did I move it for discussion?
Mr. Grossi.
One motion?
A couple questions for you. The, I don't know, as I was reading over some of the information, maybe you answered this, but what is the total amount brought in by the 2.7% premium tax?
It's approximately 4.7 million, 4.6 million, somewhere around there.
And what is the budget for the Division of Division of Workers' Compensation?
Well, in general funds, it's approximately 2.6 million.
Okay, and the Division of Insurance, do you have any idea?
What percentage of the budget for individual insurance?
I can tell you, though, the OSH section is approximately $1.5 million. Just in general funds, their total budget is higher, but they get some federal fund.
So it appears that currently the function is self-funding.
Well, I don't, you know, I would say it's over, you know, the total cost of this is over five million. I mean, I don't have an exact number on that right now, but I could get that for you.
Okay. Kay Brown and then Terry Martin.
I'll pass.
Terry Martin.
Mr. Chairman, because of the many things that were brought up and many, many questions, and I formally introduced this for discussion purposes, and made me realize that it's a major issue, and because I'm really pro on the bill, I very much believe in fee bills and helping government, that I would like to formally move the amendment now, accept it, amendment number one. I hate to get hung up on this, maybe doing the interim.
Yeah. I'll object. Mr. Chairman, another compromise that struck me, since all the parties have expressed interest in working or willingness to work on this later, what if we were to delay the effective date even further than it now is? It's now to take effect January 1, 97. If we delayed it to like July 1, I mean, I just think, you know, given the time that it takes to adopt regulations and that they haven't worked it out as to what, how to account for the costs and what the basis for the direct cost accounting should be, that if we put an up to or some language like Representative Mulder suggested earlier based on direct cost and then a delayed effective date to give enough time for something to be enacted, would be a preferable approach to what's in this amendment.
Mulder?
The only concern I have with that, Representative Brown, is there's a pretty big hammer in, mm-hmm. in the department's hands at that point in time. Not much encouragement for them to come to the table to come up with a...
Well, I guess what I would say is right now the bill would take effect in January. If you delay it to beyond the legislative session, the hammer is, you know, if it doesn't work, get worked out, it's back here with the legislature having the opportunity to readjust it. You know, so it sort of says parties go off, work it out. If it all gets worked out, fine. If it doesn't, you can take it up again next year after there's been more opportunity to look at other approaches.
There you go.
Well, then let's pull the whole section and let's say parties go work it out and come back to us next year.
I would say there's less, you know, there's less incentive for the parties to get going and work it out if you just take it out or if you put this $100 in.
Mr. Chairman?
Or no?
Just kind of following on that conversation, I think the reason that taking the section out is not necessarily an option, maybe technical more than anything, it's because in the title at line 5 and 6, it says administrative fees for self-insurers and workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be some, it needs to be addressed somewhere in the bill unless we're going to go for a title change.
Just make a reference to it.
Terry Martin.
Mr. Chairman, that was my first suggestion, just to move the whole thing out, and then I thought, well, we'd end up killing the whole bill that way, because I don't know if we have time to get it over, and I do believe in Representative Brown's concern that we need to talk this over, but I'd rather give the private industry, the payers, the opportunity. Remember, they have to earn a living. They're not just full-time government. They're the ones that pay this whole state from working. So, you know, if they had the time that our department had, full-time working for paying government and saying why we don't want to, that's one thing. But this should be a very minor part of the total. They're trying to make money, I understand. I don't know if they're successful at that. And that's their number one goal. If they don't succeed in making money, then all this is worthless. I'd rather make the motion now, accept it, and then let them negotiate and talk, and especially through Workers' Comp Association. I think it's been a real good group. Evidently, there's something happening in there that's not a understanding with each other, or there's a miscommunications. And let the Workers' Comp program work it out. Board.
Here we
go. Well, with regards to the title problem, there's always ways to get around that. We can have a $100 fee go into effect on July 1st and sunset the next day. So there's no problem. We shouldn't be driven by the title concerns.
Are we ready to vote on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, on the title, the reason for the restriction on the title is so that something new is not added. It does not mean that that which is in the bill cannot be very little reference to it, if
none.
You could just simply state under that maybe existing statutory numbers and be done with it if you like to do that. But there, if you want to get rid of it, there's easy ways to remove this from this piece of legislation. But you can't add anything new. You
Mulder.
Take out.
That was the question I had. If something in the title occurred, or if there's something in the title but there's nothing in the substance of the bill, is that a problem? I don't think it is.
Because the title is not really part of the, you know, after it's adopted, the title is just meaningless.
The real question in my mind comes down to what's going to be the greatest encouragement for the two entities to come together and come up with a suitable amount of fees. You know, is it $100 or is it simply stripping it out? I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah, in my mind it's very obviously that $100 is not what we're trying to accomplish here. And I think your arguments are in the same line as mine is, what is the level of service that is provided that you would expect to pay if you're dealing with somebody else other than a governmental entity? And because you're dealing with, in this case, the Department of Labor. But how we get there at this point, I'm not sure.
Time's short.
Cornell in Ontario.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just state that I'm more inclined to pull it out and make the department, I mean, it sends a clear message to the department that we want them to justify the direct costs of this kind of a fee, and they can come back and do that.
Ariel.
And I'm interested in that, too. I mean, I know for years my business couldn't pay a pay raise because the workman's comp rates were skyrocketing. So I am interested in seeing others contribute to the system. But I want to see it be fair. I think there is a problem with an overly inclusive title. The other day when we took care of the education funding, we adopted an amendment so that we would, you know, have something in there because of a portion of the title. It didn't do anything, but we met that requirement that the text of the bill was not silent on something that was in the title. So I think you would have to have something. But you could have a finding section saying that, you know, directing or encouraging the department to work on it over the interim. There's ways around that.
Mr. Chairman, could we have a question on this one and then the other option? Maybe we can get this off the table one way or the other. Because I know time's short.
Okay, are we ready to vote then on amendment number one? Go ahead.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Grusendorf?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Corrin?
Yes.
Representative Martin?
Yes.
Representative Mulder? No. Representative
Parnell?
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
No.
Amendment failed.
5-5.
Mulder?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we delete Section 4 from the bill.
Objection? No objection being noted. Section 4 is stripped from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I also like for the record to reflect that the deletion from the bill is in no way my concurrence with that, with the fact that I don't believe they should pay for their service. I believe the affected group and the department need to work together, and I expect they'll come back next year to give us a report of what it is. And if they don't come together, we'll have to make a determination on our own.
Appreciate your time today, sir. We have another amendment here. Tom Wright. Regarding the prisons, and I'll go ahead and offer it for discussion purposes only. Amendment number 2.
The prison.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff representative Ivan. 2 days ago, we were contacted by one of the communities in Representative Ivan's district that has a municipal facility, not a contract jail, but it is a municipal jail. It's a small community. And they were interested in seeing the fees for cost of prisoners to go from $70 to $100. Since then, there's been conversations with AML in the last couple of minutes and with DPS. This thing's kind of evolved rather quickly, but they're also interested in the possibility of saying something to the effect that a municipality may charge a prisoner who is held and charged with a crime in a municipal facility for room, board, personal expenses of the prisoner, subject to the ability of the prisoner to pay the charge, and leave it up to the municipality, you know, to determine what the charge is. I thought I'd bring that to your attention. That was just brought to my attention. But our interest is particular in the, you know, in the fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When visiting with the maker or creator of the amendment to raise it up to $100 a day, the first question comes, how many people can pay it? You know, you're oftentimes in rural Alaska talking about folks who don't have any money. The response was, well, those who can will. Most of them are indigent and won't. So it just allows us to be able to collect from those who can. So to that extent, I would support it. I think the cost of incarceration in rural Alaska is pretty high, as we all know. We've heard a lot in the last few months about. So I don't really have a problem with raising it.
Grusendorf and then Terry Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The numeral 7 is very important here because you keep adding a string of zeros and you get to $70 million. it's kind of a standard that we're following here. But I guess I have no objections to the proposed amendment of $100. But then again, you realize that that doesn't help us much in our budget for reimbursing.
To answer that question, Representative Grusendorf, I believe within, while I was outside talking with some folks, I believe that in the existing contracts that we have with the contract jails, there's language included which states that if the municipalities, these affected municipalities, do get reimbursement, that is an offset against the state contract. So in other words, the state could in fact derive a savings from this. But I want to make certain, go over with legal and pull up the contracts we do have. I have them downstairs. Go over the contracts we do have to reconfirm that in fact is the case. So there is a potential that the state could derive a savings from this. Nominal, but potentially.
Terry Martin.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm concerned about the state aspect of this. I looked at it as a increase to the cost of the state, even though I know this is what we're charging the prisoners. Is it that we're charging the prisoners $70 a day because it's the same cost we're charging the state? Or do we charge the state a different?
Mr. Chairman, I don't really feel I'm qualified to answer that. This isn't, you know, a section of the bill that.
Could the gentleman, yeah, please. My idea, sir, here is that if we adjust this fee up, does that mean that the state's going to be charged the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, my name is Bob Cole. I'm the admin director for the Department of Corrections, and there's a sort of a base clarification I want to make here. That is, when we wrote those contracts, we wrote them for a fixed price for a fixed term. So they're FY 96, 97, 98 fixed price contracts for all 15 community jails. And the amount that we entered into contract with these 15 communities for was fixed by the Community Jails Task Force prior to the time Department of Public Safety transferred the responsibility for financing these jails over to us. The contracts that we wrote with them do not have a matching requirement in them. The amount of funds that individual communities contribute to these contracts is variable. I mean, some of them put up a lot of their own cash, others put up very little or none. The cost per care in each one of these contracts is all over the board because we inherited this. So there's not a standard equitable formula for state and local share for these contracts anywhere. I remember Tom said something about somebody talked to public safety. I don't know what they talked about or what their interest is in this now since they're out of the business. I don't think the department objects to having local municipalities able to charge up to $100 a day for municipal jail services where there are municipal jails. I do think the point that Representative Mulder made is one that I can't answer immediately, and that is I don't think that there is an offsetting provision in our contracts. No, sir. We can double check that, but I don't think that if they were very aggressive about charging people for local cost under our existing contracts, I think the money would stay with the municipality and not revert to the state under existing terms. And we would have to, as a good faith measure, I think, live with the contracts as they are until the end of the term, a year and a half from now, before we would want to change them.
Bob, is there the possibility that a municipality could so-called double dip in this occasion?
Mr. Chairman, depends on what you mean, Representative Mulder, by double dipping. A lot of these community jails, as I said, put local share into, cash share into these contracts. SIPCA is a good example, and I think Kodiak puts up a fair amount of money. Just there are others, but I just point those out as two examples. In probably only one or two of the 15 cases where we have contracts does the state bear the full cost of the local jail facility, in my memory. And I think most of those communities would argue that, yeah, they understood the community jails task force recommendations and agreed to them before the jail contracts were transferred to us, but I think a very large number of those communities believe that those contracts are underfunded and that the state share does not meet the total operating costs that they're incurring there. So were you to ask a majority of the actual jail operators in those local municipalities, I doubt they think that that it would be double dipping. I think they think it would be an ability to fill some of the cost holes that exist in their vision of what these contracts look like.
Well, Mr. Cole, that's my basic question here, is that when we raise the basic level of $70 to $100, and we know that most of the people are indigent, who pays it? The city pays it on behalf of that person, or the state pays it on behalf of that person?
As it stands now, Representative Martin, if the cost of jail was X, let's say, and the state's contribution to that was X minus 2, whatever that was, then it's a local municipal responsibility to fill in the blanks. And as I said, it's all over the board, the amount of contribution they've made to it.
So you can't say that this is going to be an increase to the state?
Sir? No, I wouldn't say that it would be an increase to the state at all.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, Brown.
I call a question on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Gusendorf?
Yeah, I would like to recant my utterances in relation to the support of the $100 increase. In looking at the contractual arrangements, unless that municipality can recoup that extra, what would that be, $30, I think I'd like to stay at the $70 a day range. I guess that would be basically the no frills no frills program that we have in our contracts.
TV.
I don't think it should be amended.
Go ahead, Bill.
Representative Corey.
Pass.
Representative Martin.
Pass.
Representative Mulder.
Pass.
Representative Navarre.
No.
Representative Parnell.
No.
Representative Terrio.
No.
Representative Brown.
No.
Representative Grusendorf.
No.
Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Corey.
I'll vote yes.
Representative Martin.
No.
Representative Mulder.
Yes.
4 yeas, 6 nays.
Any other amendments on this bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Terrio and then Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to the committee to consider dropping out this section on the subdivision plan reviews.
Which one?
That's the DEC section, lines 13 through 17.
Page 5. Discussion?
I think there needs to be some discussion between the administration and the local governments over, number one, who should provide this function. I know there's a lot of frustration in Fairbanks that you work with somebody, an engineer, come up with a subdivision plan review, turn it into DEC, they turn it into statewide DEC, somebody in Juneau is trying to make a decision on a subdivision up in Fairbanks that's designed around permafrost and particular soil conditions, and there's not a real level of comfort that there's an understanding of the local conditions. I just wish that the administration would do more negotiations with the municipalities up front, see how this, who should provide this, who's best equipped to provide this service, and then come to us with it.
Hey, Brian.
Well, I'd object to taking this out because I think if we had left the money in the budget so that the function could continue, I think there would be less urgency to get the fee structure in place. But I'd point out that the way we have left the situation does not seem adequately covered in a number of instances, and I think we are affecting people's property values. There was testimony that in places where these are not adequately done, there's impacts to private individuals, and I think this proposal makes a lot of sense under the circumstances that we have removed the money enabling the department to carry on and do this. And so I don't see what would be accomplished. And I just say there has been, you know, a lot of discussion. I mean, it's not as if, you know, it's never been discussed. And I think this would give more impetus to try to bring some resolution to it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe Ms. Adair can come back up, but I don't think it's correct that we cut the funding for this function. The funding for this particular function was left in the transfer to statewide public services. The department chose to take the cut that was made and spread it to this function.
Well, I just say the result is the money is not in the budget at this time, and the function doesn't seem like it's going to be done unless we come up with a way to pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Terrio, I think we're all correct. Subcommittee did not specifically identify subdivision plan reviews in the reduction that it took to this division, statewide public service. However, it is the only function in statewide public service that is wholly general funded, and it was the only place, the dollar amount was about the same. It was the place that made the most sense. We are at the position in DEC that we can't nickel and dime anymore. It's got to be full programs that go when reductions are at all high. And that was just a choice we were faced with. It is absolutely correct that it was not identified. It just is the only place that was left.
Are you on then, Mark?
Well, Mr. the discussion on whether we can empower local engineers to do this, the local government could do that too, right? If the local government took over the function but didn't want to put together a big staff at the borough level, on the local level through an ordinance, could they empower a bonded engineer to do this work?
Through the chair, Representative Terrio, there is some question about that, and it is something that we have been looking into, but I can't say that we have an answer. This is a public health function, and there are often restrictions on delegating to a private entity a public health function that is something seen as an inherent power of the government to do. But we do recognize, I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do is establish the program in such a way with a fee basis so that a local government could could take it over. There are some structural changes that need to be made to the program as well. It would be, at that point, the developers would be used to paying the fee, and it may not be as controversial then for a local government to do it if we kind of take the hits in the up front and establish the program, establish the fee, and then move it over.
You know what I think I'll do? We've got a caucus right now. This is amendment number 5, I think, right?
Well,
this is a conceptual amendment you're offering?
I'll withdraw my.
You're withdrawing it?
Consider it on the floor, but I think the.
I'd like to reconvene at a later date and bring this up again.
I'd like to move that we report this bill out with individual recommendations and accompany fiscal note.
Yes. Agree.
Just a slight technical.
If it's very quick.
I'll kill it on the floor.
There's a drafting error in the effective dates, and the gasohol exemption sections do not appear in the effective dates, and so we'd clause. So we need to change section 16 on page 6 to include sections 8 and 12.
8 and 12. Okay.
I'll move the amendment.
Approved.
No objection. It's moved. We'll take a quick at ease here for a few minutes.
Okay, come on. On the motion.
And what?
We're waiting on. Withdraw the motion.
Right. Okay, we'll reconvene then at the call of the chair. I don't know what time that'll be. Thank you.
Kay didn't withdraw.
Call House Finance Committee meeting back to order. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move we report from committee Senate Bill 216 with the accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing none, SB 216 has been reported from committee. I think we're going to have to wrap up around a few people. What the intent is to get 215, try and pass that out, SCR 23, that long-range planning resolution, and then go to the floor.
Yeah. We're ready with 216?
We already passed out 216, so...